Hey, I'm Father Roderick, and welcome to my show. I'm recording this on a Saturday evening after a warm, warm day and a very, very busy week. In this show, we will talk about fairy tales, about Star Wars, technology, games, and about the rapture. This show is made possible thanks to my patrons. They support me over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick, and they allow me to bring you these shows free of any annoying advertisement. And so I won't waste your time with ads. I will waste your time with all the other stuff that I'm talking about. But hopefully you can appreciate the ad-free perspective of these shows. And if you want to join them, if you want to help me with my mission to reach out through new media, not just through audio, but also through video, then I encourage you to go and take a look over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick. And I'm super happy for all the support.
Do you know what's going on?
This is what's happening in your world.
They said Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
So the studio today looks a bit like a fairy tale place. For those of you that have watched the live stream, which, by the way, I'm always streaming this live on Facebook, so if you follow me on Facebook, you may get notified. I think there's even a button on Facebook that you can click so you can get the notifications from either the Tridio Media Facebook page or my personal Father Roderick Facebook page. And on the video stream, you will see that I'm actually sitting in front of a very beautiful, nice, romantic, dwarven homestead. It looks a bit, the roof looks like a red mushroom with white dots on it, but it's actually a little house, and there are dwarves in living both inside the house, in front of it. I'm kind of blocking the view, but there is also a dwarf fishing. There's a little pond in front of the house, and this is a real house that you can visit, that you can walk through, and you can see these dwarves moving there. And all of this can be seen at one of the most famous theme parks of the Netherlands, which is called the Efteling, and it is a very old fairy tale based attraction park. Nowadays, of course, it has a lot of modern attractions, and it's kind of similar to Disneyland, and at various points also inspired by, but it's actually was created around the same time. However, this is a very Dutch theme park. The park looks, most of that was designed by a Dutch artist, Anton Peek, who loved kind of this old-fashioned Charles Dickens-like style, and so he wanted to create a world that even though it would show you the world of all these fairy tale characters, it would at the same time be believable and feel real. And so it's much less kind of clean looking compared to, for instance, Disney. If you go to Disneyland or Disney World, it's very much you're inside the Disney aesthetics, and it's all bright and clean and cheerful. This is more romantic. It's more European in a certain way. And a lot of these houses and little castles that you will encounter, they're really built inside a park. The park was there before the fairy tale world was created there. And so it all feels much more natural, more real than in a way than Disneyland does. It is also relatively small, or at least the fairy tale part is small. But then, of course, they added roller coasters. And the one thing they did very well was, even though they added all sorts of extra kind of more modern attractions, they still always spun a story around it. So they also created their own fairy tales around those modern attractions. And I think the whole park kind of breathes a certain kind of a unified atmosphere. It's kind of the same. You feel that it's all part of the same storytelling. And in that respect, it's much less like now you're in the pirate world and now you're in a Buzz Lightyear's world. It's much less segregated. It feels more like a unified park. So very much worth your time if you ever visit the Netherlands. I went there on Thursday because I had to film an interview for a television episode and potentially also a Tridio production about fairy tales and about the role of values and faith even in fairy tales. It's a topic that has always been a passion of mine. I was an avid fairy tale reader when I was a kid. And well, you know me. I love fantastical stories. And in many ways, even movies like Star Wars, the Marvel Universe, those are all modern fairy tales. But the kind of the core value, I think, of those imaginary tales is that they are transmitting values. They teach you what's right, what's wrong, how to behave, how to be a hero, how not to be a hero, and that's something that I wanted to focus on in this episode. And this being such a Dutch fairy tale park made it something I just could not leave out. It's like if I were an American and I would live in the United States, of course I would do a segment about Disney in an episode or a documentary about fairy tales. The second reason that I wanted to interview the current creative director of the park, so the one who actually supervises the storytelling of the park, is its Catholic origin. He told me during the interview that when he was a boy, 13 years old, he worked at this fairy tale park, and he heard the story about how it all began. And actually, the park was there, and there was a small parish, but there was a lot of poverty in that region, and the local priest, the pastor, with his vicar, they both were looking for ways to help the local population, to help them generate some income or start activities. And they came up with this idea that they said, we have this land, we have this park, why don't we create a park where everyone can play for the children of the neighborhood, and then we'll just start with some football or soccer. We'll expand later on. And very soon, these parishes came up with this idea. Well, what if we do more than just a sports park? What if we create a couple of fairy tales? And it may very well be that they had heard about Disneyland, although, you know, in those days, I don't think there was much communication between the various continents. This was way before we got word about it. So they may have read articles about this. Actually, I should probably look this up if the Efteling was made before Disneyland. Let me see. Efteling, Wikipedia. I think it started in the 30s. And so there is still a photograph of the very first soccer match where you see the priest in his cassock kicking the ball for the first time. Let me see this is actually, I think this is much later than I thought. It started, the official opening date was in 1952, but I think that the idea of the fairy tales, right here, it says on the Dutch Wikipedia page, the actual opening of the park was in the 30s. That's where these priests opened the sports and leisure park. And let's see, Disneyland, when did that start? Disneyland. So I don't know exactly at what time they started the fairy tale stories. Oh, there you go. So the Disneyland was opened on July 17th, 1955. So I think actually, so the Efteling's probably much older, but I wouldn't be surprised if the idea of doing fairy tales was actually inspired by what they heard about Disneyland that was developing at the same time. Anyway, they're still telling stories, and the parishes have been involved in the let's say the whole business side of the park for decades, and it's only recently, I don't know exactly when, but like 20 years ago, that the parishes actually stepped back and it became a commercial enterprise. But the whole Catholic vibe is still there, and Catholics, of course, love stories, and they know how important it is to not just approach faith and the values and morality from the point of view of just the intellectual point of view, but it's very biblical to always transmit these values and important things in life through stories and through storytelling. And a lot of the fairy tales that we know and love have Christian origins because the writers had a Christian background. And so the values that they thought were important were brought into these stories. So a lot of these fairy tales are moral tales. They had an educational purpose, and that is still the case. And when I asked him, so what is the purpose of the fairy tales you tell nowadays? Because now the park has an international audience, and the world has changed so much since the beginning of that park. He said something important. He said the most important thing that we want is that people experience what it means to be a child here. And oftentimes they've been here as children. Now they're back with their children or grandchildren. And when you step into this park, you can again look at the world the way a child looks at the world. And you experience the wonder and the surprise. And there's even this whole philosophy that if something happens, a child falls or gets hurt or anything, the people that run the park have been instructed to always go the extra mile and to make it magical and add so much care and love and ice cream so that the child, instead of having a traumatic memory of that event of falling or hurting itself, will have this even more magical experience. And I love that because you may wonder, well, where's faith in that? Well, isn't it one of the important things that Jesus teaches us? If you don't become a child, like a child, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. A child looks at the world in a very positive way. The world is full of possibilities. And of course, children do nasty things as well. But there is always something that we associate with children that has to do with kind of a reboot. A child is at the start of his or her life, and so anything is still possible. Whereas adults often get cynical, desperate. They can't see the wonder in life anymore. The only thing that we often see are the problems or the struggles that we have. And a child can see, and I've seen this, I've witnessed this, and it was so funny. At one point, he's like, I'm going to show you what I mean. And he says, I'm going to take you to one of the simplest attractions that we have in this park, the cheapest ones to make, the ones that have been here since the very beginning of the park, and are still, for little children, one of the most popular attractions. So I was like wondering, where is he going to take me? Is he going to take me to Little Red Riding Hood or the story of, I don't know, Cinderella? And instead he brings me to this mushroom. It's a mushroom that is about the size of a small chair. And it's brightly painted, white on the stem and then red with white dots. And there is a little speaker inside the mushroom, and it plays classical music. And he says, children love to go sit on that mushroom and feel like they're part of this magical forest. You'll see. And 1 minute later, exactly what, like he predicted, there's these two little children, I think they're like three or four, and they see this mushroom. And for them, of course, it looks like a big mushroom. And immediately they start climbing on it. That the parents weren't telling them to do it. And there was this little girl just sitting on top of that mushroom, looking like a princess. She's like, I'm going to sit here. And she was laughing at her parents and she was laughing at me. And I was like, wow, that, I think that is a lost art for us adults. That we should learn this from children, to look at the world and to be happy with the simple things and to just sit on that mushroom, enjoy this magical music that somehow magically comes from this mushroom, And that's all you need. There's no roller coaster that can beat the quality of that experience. And so I was filming all those stories, and I just had a blast, and I'm super, super happy with the result. And then for the rest of the day, we were invited to just walk around, and we could film anything we wanted. And so, whoa, visually for me, this was a fairy tale land as well, because everything was beautiful. And of course, it brought back a lot of memories from the times that I was still an altar boy, and the local priest would take all the altar boys and girls to the Efteling to thank us for our service during the year. I think that's of course, the price of admission was a lot lower than it is nowadays, although it's still not. It's about half the price you would pay to go to Disneyland. But go check it out. If you're in the Netherlands, go to the Efteling. You'll love it.
How do you not like movies?
They're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl, and that kid sees dead people, and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm gonna give it to you.
I'm still waiting for Ant-Man and the Wasp. That movie premieres, I think, in a few days from now, so I can't review it on this episode. I will probably review it next week. Instead, I'm going to bring you two movies, not very well-known movies, but I saw them last week, so let's talk about them. One is Adrift. That one is still in theaters in the Netherlands, or I think actually premiered in the Netherlands just this week. But I saw it in an early showing, sneak peek, or sneak preview or something like that. And it's called Adrift. And Adrift is based on a true story of two avid sailors. I'm reading this from the description on IMDb. As two avid sailors set out on a journey across the ocean, Tammy Oldman and Richard Sharp couldn't anticipate they would be sailing directly into one of the most catastrophic hurricanes in recorded history. In the aftermath of the storm, Tammy awakens to find Richard badly injured and their boat in ruins. With no hope for rescue, Tammy must find the strength and determination to save herself and the only man she has ever loved. And it's a movie, I think, that takes place in the 80s or in the 90s. So, as I said, it is based on a true story. However, what you see in the movie is a little bit different from what happened in real life, and that has to do with the story. But I won't spoil anything here. What was very good about the movie was just the way they filmed the storm and everything. Oh my goodness! This was not in 3D, thankfully, because I probably would have vomited. I was like, I've always been a little bit apprehensive of the sea and sailing and everything, and I've gone sailing with friends, school friends, in the past, and even on a quiet day, I already thought it was like scary because there's just this power of the wind, and I don't know, there's something unpredictable about being out on the on open water and having just the wind that will push you if you know how to steer a boat, of course, which I don't know how to do, by the way. And so a storm, and just the way it was portrayed, is like, that's not for me. And so that was very well done. What is not so good is the love story. There are tons and tons of flashbacks, because the actual story on sea is, I mean, I was expecting more of a survival type of movie. And I enjoy survival movies. But instead, they opted to go, and I don't know why exactly, but there are so many flashbacks on how these two got to know each other. And all that is so predictable and really bad dialogue and cliche. And it was cringeworthy, really. So what salvaged the movie was just the scenes on the open water, the storm, the kind of the more the real stuff, the romance kind of felt sappy and just I don't know, run of the mill. The other movie that I wanted to briefly talk about is a terrible movie. Oh my goodness! It showed up on Netflix, and I was like, yeah, I heard about that movie a few years ago, and let's check it out. And it's called, what was it again? Left Behind. This is based on a very popular American book series that for the premise is based on this concept of the rapture, which is a Protestant, it's not even old Protestants, it's like a certain part of the Protestant, certain Protestant denominations believe, have a the idea that the at one point in time, and they base this, I think, on a erroneous interpretation of the apocalypse. At one point in time, God will start the end. You know, the kind of the end, and the end of the world happens in phases. And the first thing that God does is He's going to take people away, hence the word rapture, without any warning, without seemingly without also any reason. He will just take certain people away and bring them straight to heaven. And then the rest of the people just stays on earth and, well, has to deal with the chaos that ensues. That whole premise, of course, a Catholic does not believe in the rapture. And if you've heard of it and you might have thought that that is something that a lot of Christians believe, No. Actually, it's also very American. It's not something that I had ever heard of here in Europe. So it is this whole idea of rapture is actually very new. I think someone came up with that in the 19th century, around 1850 in the United States. And so it is, yeah. It's dumb. It's a dumb idea. Actually, the movie is super dumb. Oh my goodness. This may be the worst movie with Nicolas Cage that I've ever seen. And you know what? That is saying a lot, because Nicolas Cage is in a lot of terrible movies. But this one, I think, beats everything. The whole idea. So don't watch this movie. It's so dumb. It's a waste of time. Anyway, Nicolas Cage is a pilot who has an extramarital affair. His wife is super religious and always beating everything over the head with, you know, God and the Bible and stuff. And at first, you kind of think that, well, yeah, you kind of side with the people that think that she's exaggerating. And then there's this other lady that is talking in an airport to a famous journalist, and she says, well, you know, those disasters that you report on as a journalist, don't you think that God has to do something with that? And then he's like, crazy lady. And as a viewer, you're also, that's really stupid. I mean, that's not how God works, Han Solo would say, if he were Catholic. So it is, and then the rapture happens, and so people just disappear. Like, in 1 second, they're there, and then, like, half of the people are gone, and only their clothes are left. And so lots of airplanes are crashing, and cars and buses fall into the sea, and there are explosions, and people start looting, and it's a total disaster. But then the worst message of this movie, and probably of the book as well, is that, well, that was God's plan, you know? And don't say He didn't warn you, because the crazy lady at the airport and the crazy lady that was married to the pilot, you know, they should have known better. It's like, what kind of message is that? What are you trying to blame God for? That He's, like, God is Thanos. It's Infinity Wars. Like, God is, like, sitting there all purple, and He's like, oh, I'm just gonna do this, click, and, like, half of the people are gone. What kind of really blows my mind that people take that seriously, and that is actually something that these books are daring to attribute to God. It's the craziest thing ever. And then they're also the movie is from what I've heard, because I don't want to waste more time by reading the books, but apparently the books are very openly anti-Catholic, and the whole premise is that the Pope is an imposter and is a disciple of Satan, and it's all going to hell. But God has different plans, and then after the rapture, there's this in-between time, and people will have to somehow kind of figure out how to make things work, even though God has already brought like half of the people to heaven. And then I guess that Jesus will come back and kind of wrap things up? I have no idea. I'm really not interested in that kind of stuff. What this is, I think, is a very stupid and a perverted take on what is actually a part of theology, and it's called eschatology. The word eschatology is from the Greek word eschatos, which means last, and, well, logi, study of. So it's the study of the last things. And eschatology is something that, of course, is part of theology because in the final book of the Bible, the book of Revelations or the Apocalypse, we have these descriptions of what will happen in the future, what's happening right now between Jesus having gone back to his Father with the ascension and the return of Jesus that he himself actually talks about. I will return in glory, says Jesus. And so theology has always reflected upon this. What does that mean? And what does it mean for our time? Because, of course, Jesus has already vanquished death by sacrificing his own life on the cross. And through the resurrection, there is this definitive victory over death. And yet we still live in this in-between time where not everything is saved yet, and there is still evil, and people still do stupid things, and the evil spirits and Satan is still somehow kind of pulling people back from God's love. And so that is something that eschatology has to deal with. And so what you always have to be aware of is that the book of the Apocalypse, the book of Revelations, is like a lot of the other books in the Bible, is a specific literary genre. This is not just a literary genre that you find in the Bible. You find that in other writings as well. And so it means that you have to decode it. You can't just take that as this is just all literally going to happen in a literal way. It was never meant to be a literal description of the end of times. So when the Apocalypse is talking about numbers, etc., a lot of these, what I would say, slightly misguided people start, they take out their calculator and they're trying to find the number of 666 and the number of the beast, and that goes back to the credit card number of Bill Clinton, and that's why it's the end of the times right now. And they interpret a lot of the events that they see on TV and that they experience in their times as kind of a proof of, well, here you go, it's going to happen. And that's kind of the premise of the movie as well, with the Thanos is here, and he's going to flip his fingers, and, that's the rapture. The Catholic theology has always been very careful and very prudent, I think, in the way she talks about the things to come, because we are not God. We don't know what lies ahead. We know a lot about the things that God probably won't do, because if God is love, and even though his plans are different from our plans, there has to be a certain logic to the things that God does. It has to be the logic of love. Well, I still haven't found a good explanation why taking away people from planes and buses, etc., and letting the world turn to total chaos and disaster, how that can ever be part of God's loving plan. And so there is this question in the movie about, what about, how can you reconcile God with disasters, etc., etc.? Well, my answer would always be, God didn't spare his own son the disaster of death and suffering, but his answer is love. There is something totally wrong and illogical about death in our current world. That's why eschatology is always pointing us towards the end of times, that this is not the final plan of God. We're part of this final time, the end times. That's what we have been in since the return of Jesus. And there is the church who is called to be like Jesus and to help wherever they can help to save people from suffering, from cruelty, from abuse, from disaster, etc., etc. And of course, in the church is made out of sinners, and so the church has committed great sins and has made huge mistakes. And at the same time, there's been incredible generosity, self-sacrifice, and holiness as well inside that same church. And so this whole black and white simplification of, well, that Catholic stuff, that's all fake because look at all the wrongdoings of the church, and taking the apocalypse like a literal description. And oftentimes they will read the first books of the Bible in the same way. You know, it's like, it says in the Bible, God created the earth in 7 days. And so, yeah, no dinosaurs there. And if there are dinosaurs, dinosaur bones, it's probably the devil that hit them in the ground to confuse us and to help to make us not believe in the literal truth of Genesis. Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, a little bit of Bible study would be very helpful, I think, because, again, the Bible is a book that consists of many different books written in many different literary forms, different times, different subtext, a lot of rewrites as well. It doesn't make it less the Word of God, but it's the Word of God that is written down by us, by humans that live in a certain culture, that have a certain language. The Word of God is part of the incarnation, actually. It's like Jesus was born in a certain time, in a certain culture, in a certain tradition, used certain images. And with Jesus, too, you have to go back and ask yourself this question. So if he says this, what is he referring to? What kind of language was used? What kind of images were people using at in his time? How does Jesus say something different from the other rabbis in his time, et cetera, et cetera? So even there with the gospel, you're decoding, you're trying. That's why we have the Bible study. That's why Catholic Bibles will have all these footnotes. You can't just read this and say, well, it says here, this is what happened. And so that's exactly literally how it happened. And even if you would read the Bible literally like that, you will find so many contradictions that it almost becomes obvious that, of course, it needs interpretation and you need to know more about the literary genres, about the context, about the culture, about the language in order to get to the real meaning of these texts. Doesn't mean, by the way, that you have to be a theologian to read the Bible, but there are different layers of interpretation. But I do get very itchy when I see people kind of run away with the apocalypse and the book of Revelations and then turning that into basically false doctrine, according to me. It's like, and it thwarts, I think, the image that people have of God. What kind of God is that? That is like Thanos. That's not my God. Absolutely not. So anyway, there's a lot to say about this. If you want to read up on the doctrine of the Catholic Church about the eschatology, you can find that in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is available for free on the website of the Vatican. And it's in article, let's see, it's in the Profession of Faith, and it's article 7. This is based on the Creed. So it explains the Creed, and in the Creed, of course, you have the phrase, from hence he will come again. So I believe in Jesus Christ, who has gone back to his Father. From hence he will come again to judge the living and the dead. So he will come again in glory. If you go to article 7, that it will expand upon that. It will show you what church fathers have said about that and what the current theological thinking is in the Catholic Church about these end times. And, well, who can predict when all that will happen? Only God knows the day and the time. And that's a warning that's in the Bible itself. So, yeah, rapture. Let's forget about it.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
Something totally different. That's what they would do in Monty Python when they would change the topic and they would have another joke or sketch. And no, there would be this nude guy sitting playing the piano and he would look at the camera and say, and now for something totally different. We would always love that. Probably nowadays it would be censored, but not when I was young. Anyway, now for something totally different. A book. I am currently reading or listening to the audiobook, but there's also a Kindle version of that. It's called How to Lose a Marathon by Joel Cohen. His last name indicates a Jewish origin. That's what he is. And he is also a writer for The Simpsons. And that makes this a crazy funny book about saw a guy, actually totally out of shape, kind of lazy, who decides that he wants to run a marathon. And he describes his first experience. Now, this is probably not going to be too interesting for people that have never ran or have no interest in running. But if you've ever run even a small race, like a 10K or something like that, or a half marathon, or a marathon, you'll recognize so much. And this book made me realize how much this marathon culture is the same wherever you go. Because he's describing his American experience. And the same is, I had exactly the same experiences, the same people that said the same things to me here in the Netherlands. And it's super funny. What I didn't know, because I bought this when there's this website, actually, that every day puts an Audible book on sale. I'll include the link. I always go there every day. I go to the page which has the daily deals for on Amazon for Kindle books. And if I find a deal that I like, I'm usually posted also on Facebook and on Twitter. There's also the Audible daily deal. And actually, I think it's just audible.com/daily deal. And you can buy an audiobook. And normally these audiobooks are expensive. They're like $20, $24, $25. And they will reduce the price to about $2, $3. So I picked this one up for, I think, $1.99 or something like that, $1.95. So I was listening to the audiobook and laughing out loud all the time. But then I paged through the Kindle book. You have the preview of the Kindle book on the Amazon side. And then I was like, oh, I should have bought the Kindle book, because he also puts in a lot of illustrations and they're hilarious. And that, of course, you can't narrate that in the audiobook. So that would be a reason to check out the Kindle book. By the way, he's a writer for The Simpsons. Definitely not someone who draws for The Simpsons, because this is really the kind of a doodle type of quality. This is but it's funny, because you got the same humor in those illustrations as well. So I've got the book here in front of me, and let me see if I can read a little portion of this. Let's see. So he's about that he's lazy, etc., etc. Well, I'll just read this. What I actually meant is, instead of bragging, I'd like this book to be more a retelling of how I, a lazy lump with more chins than trophies, actually ran a marathon. Self-deprecation is omnipresent in this book. From the depths of my ineptitude, I want you to find inspiration. If it's done right, and we both know it won't be, instead of saying, look what I did, this book should say, look what I did, and now imagine how much better you can do. Lastly, as I detail my journey from a guy who barely finished Marathon Man, the movie, to a guy who barely finished a marathon, I will try to highlight relevant advice when and where I have it. Keep in mind, none of these tips come from a professional runner or a professional trainer, but maybe that's why they were worthwhile. They're the little things a complete amateur, me, saw, felt, experienced, and now feel merit passing on. And so... yeah, it's just super, super funny. And I actually don't know if he wrote any other books. If he did, I want to read them. No, I think this is his only book. I should ask Luis Escobar. He's probably listening to this podcast in a while, if he knows Joel. Because, Luis works for The Simpsons. By the way, speaking of Luis, he actually was part of, the Infinity War secrets podcast on sqpn.com. That was a great conversation. Go check it out. So there's this show, Secrets of Movies, TV Shows, and Games. And then Dom gathers a number of people in a panel, and they talk about recent movies. So they did Solo, The Last Jedi. And then there was Avengers showed up in the feed recently. And Luis is part of that. But anyway. I digress. Let's move over to the Peculiar Bunch.
Speaking of Simpsons, they're all over this jingle.
Catholics rock!
Oh.
Cannibals can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What did I eat, light bulbs?
I think I was supposed to talk over this jingle, but I was looking up my show notes, so I forgot. I apologize. I want to talk about something that happened this morning.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
So this morning I slept in. I was still so tired after the filming the entire day at the Efteling and this fairy tale park. It was a super hot day, very humid. I was completely exhausted, and so I woke up and I have to. I'm following this marathon schedule, so I had to run 6 miles. But the sun was already up. It was already warming up. And so I was like, I'll probably run on the treadmill. But the house, inside the house, is even warmer than outside. So I had to move my portable air conditioning thing to the other room. And so I was like, all sweaty and everything, and trying to get the air conditioning working in the room where I have the treadmill. And then I hear the bell downstairs. What now? I have no appointments today. So I have this intercom. So I pick up the intercom. Yes, can I help you? Yes, two ladies. We are so-and-so. And we would like to talk to... we are talking to people about family and ideas about... family and family life in general, and perhaps you would be interested to talk about that topic with us. And I was like, okay. So I was like, actually, I had a like. This sounds like Jehovah's Witnesses. It was the kind of, but there's also the possibility that these are, I don't know, Catholic people from a Catholic group that have heard about this Father Roderick and they want to have a conversation about, I don't know, family, pastoral, whatever. So I had this sense that there's something wrong about this, but I didn't want to say outright, like, you're Jehovah's Witnesses, go away. And so I was like, not really right now. Actually, no, I'm not interested. That's a pity. We would like to encourage you to go to, there's a website about this, this family advice, and it can be, it's a really interesting website, very good website. So go to www.blahblahblah. And I was like, that doesn't sound like a website about family advice. So I say, okay, goodbye. And I hang up, and then I didn't want to go to the website because that sounded like a marketing thing, you know, that people like they type that in and go to the website. So I type in information and then the URL in Google, and immediately it's like, oh, duh, Jehovah's Witnesses. So I wrote a little blurb on Facebook to direct it to my Dutch followers. Because you can now do that. You can target a post to a specific target audience. So I wrote it in Dutch. I was like, apparently the Jehovah's Witnesses have a new marketing strategy. Instead of telling me that they are Jehovah's Witnesses, they're having this vague story about family life. And they will point you to a website. And that website is actually just, it's the Watchtower thing. It's just the Jehovah's Witness Watchtower thing. So beware. You know, when you get this strange story, it's just basically... Jehovah's Witnesses propaganda, and it was like, ladies, next time, just be honest about why you knock on people's doors. And then I was surprised to see so many reactions on Facebook. Like, oh my gosh, I've had exactly that same experience. And I actually was like, I was a bit negative in that post because, I am, to put it mildly, not a fan of the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's a sectarian movement, and it's very, very bad for people. There's a lot of... And I know this for a fact, because I've talked to people that actually were Jehovah's Witnesses. I had them crying in my previous rectory. Usually they go two by two to evangelize. I kind of always hesitate to use even Christian terms, because this is not a Christian... a movement. This is not a church. There's nothing Christian about them. They have a Bible, but that Bible is not the real Bible.
It's a mistranslation, oftentimes even a purposely, let's say, reformulated Bible to kind of suit their doctrine, their ideology. So usually they go two by two. They're actually forced to do that. It's an obligation if you are a Jehovah's Witness. You have to go door by door, or you have to stand on a – nowadays you find them a lot at railway stations. And then they have to get rid of their material, their Watchtower magazines and their folders and flyers and everything. And they have a very good CRM, customer management relations system. So they write down everything. If you don't open the door, they'll write that down. If you say, well, today I don't want to talk about it, they'll write that down, and you bet you will get another duo visiting you the next day or a week later. It's like, you said you didn't have time last week. Would you have time right now? If you take a flyer, if you think, well, just give me the flyer and get out of here, they'll write that down. Took a flyer. And then they'll get back to you. Did you read the flyer? What do you think of it? That's how they do that. I've heard this from people that actually are no longer part of the Jehovah's Witnesses. They will look at the newspapers and look at people that, for instance, have lost a beloved one, a death in a family. Or they will go visit those people because they know that they're vulnerable, that they may be more open to conversation, conversion, whatever. Now, usually they go two by two so they can actually control each other and report back to the base camp. They have like leaders for these groups. They have to report back to them. But every once in a while, you will get someone who goes solo, sometimes because the other person got ill that morning or something like that. And when they're solo, that's sometimes when you can break through the kind of the brainwashed part of their discourse. And so I remember in my first parish, I'd been a priest for 2-3 years. There's this person. First it was in the winter. You got two people, and they have a baby with them. And it's like below freezing point outside, and they've got a baby with them. And they were clearly using the baby to get into people's houses. And like, I hate it when they do that. That's so wrong. But anyway, second time, there's this guy, and he it was on a Saturday morning. Usually they usually come to it on Saturday morning. And it's like, do you believe in God? It's like, look at what the sign says. Rectory, Roman Catholic priest. What do you think? Yeah, but you may not believe the right things. Okay. Really? Okay. Well, humor me. So I started to ask questions. And very soon, he of course realized that he was talking to a theologian, and that I knew a little bit more about the Bible text than perhaps the other people that he had visited before. And so he started to become a little bit insecure, and he's like, yeah, I've got a book for those difficult things. And so he started to look up the my objections. Of course, I was like, well, here in your Bible, give me your Bible. Here, it says, let me get the Greek, the real text. Here in Greek, it says so and so and so. Here in the translation, just look at the front cover of your book. What does it say? This was translated from ancient texts into English. And this is a Dutch translation, not of the original text. This is a Dutch translation of the English translation. So you're using a translation of a translation of the original text. You have no way to verify that, right? You don't know any Greek. You don't know any Hebrew. Well, so he had this blue book, I remember, and it had a lot of the objections by Catholics. And he would quote me from that. And of course, well, after about an hour or so, I was like, this doesn't really make sense to have this theological discussion with this guy. I mean, he can't help it. He's been brainwashed. And so I ask him, and he was getting tired of it as well. So I ask him, "What? Let me ask you one thing. Are you happy? Do you really feel happy?" "Well, I'm happy to be among the number of the elected that will blah, blah, blah." But personally, do you feel happy? Do you have joy in your life? And then he broke. He broke down. He started to cry. And like, okay. And actually, he said, no, no, I'm not happy. And he was like, can I come in? So we went inside. So I kept him at the door for 2 hours. And I was like, so why are you not happy? What don't you like about your life? And then he started to tell his story and how much he was pressured by the church and how miserable he was, and that they made him break with his entire family, including his wife and children. He couldn't see them anymore because he had failed to convert them. And they used that as leverage to put extra pressure on him. And so the way he described it, the fact that he failed to convert his wife and his children was putting him on a lower rank than other Jehovah Witnesses. And just the stories he told me. And so I brought him to the door. I said, you know what? If you ask me, I think you should get out of there. You're in a sectarian movement. And find help. Try to step out of it. Dude, really, believe me, this is not good for you, and this is not what God wants for you. And I said, I will pray for you. I'll ask you to pray for me as well. If you clearly want the best for me, or your church wants the best for me, then you can pray for me. But when you pray, ask God if this is where he wants you to be. I've never heard back of the guy. But I felt that that's the only time that I was able to break through that kind of the wall of disinformation that he had been indoctrinated with. And again, it was just such a strong experience that made me realize how important it is to have good theology, and to that theology is part of any formation, not just for priests and deacons, but also for lay people. If you work in a parish, if you're volunteering in catechesis, make sure you get a good theological formation yourself. I'm sure your diocese will have options for that. But educate yourself, because ignorance leads to these almost cartoonish versions of the truth, and it causes so much trouble. That was a little bit about it. And I was also glad to see a lot of people in the comments under my Facebook post telling stories about their own experiences. There was one guy who said, actually, I used to be part of that of the Jehovah Witnesses. And yes, a lot of these things are true. We do track everyone. We get not just days, but weeks and weeks of training on how to convert people, how to get the conversation going, how to come back to them. And it's, such a well-oiled machine. But I'm always like, if this is not the truth, there are probably many more things that are wrong. And I think that if you look at follow the money. Follow the money. That's also true, by the way, for Catholics. You know, if you want to, one of the big things that Pope Francis did, he took this job from Benedict, Pope Benedict, who started this, was to clean up that financial mess around the Vatican Bank and everything. If there's money involved, if there's sex involved, et cetera, those are very, very huge warning signs that there is something rotten inside the Vatican or inside your church. And I wouldn't be surprised if you follow the money in the Jehovah Witnesses structure. You'll end up at, I think, a very, very rich, rich upper layer of the church. And recently, in my country at least, there have been revelations by former members of the Jehovah Witnesses that have come forward and have talked about the abuse, sexual abuse, taking place in at a large scale inside the Jehovah Witness community. And I was actually shocked that they can keep basically they tell our government or politicians, well, we'll handle it. Nothing to worry, nothing to see here. These are not the abuses that you're looking for. Move along. And they get away with that. But this is something, we're talking about criminal behavior. And so just as the world was hypercritical towards the Catholic Church, and for a good reason. And I'm very, very glad that that happened, actually, because this is something that needs to be purged. And it doesn't belong in a church. And we still pay the price for that abuse for decades inside the church. But it's better to suffer and to suffer public humiliation and perhaps even persecution because people are reacting to this than to, you know, close the doors and say we're just going to fix this and there's nothing to see. That is the most dangerous thing that you can do. But anyway, I'm really surprised that in my country there isn't more uproar or there's more research done by journalists. So what is happening inside that very closed community? Because that's a sectarian movement. That's even more closed than certain other Christian circles. And the more you have a system of power, and it's a closed system without external reference, because if you know people outside of the church, you have to break your bonds with them. So it's a system that has no external reference. You have to be extremely careful because we know this. We've learned this over the past few years with this whole abuse crisis. Abuse is not just about sex. It's about power and inequality of power, and vulnerable people get abused by the people in power. And in a sectarian movement, of course, there is even more danger for that. So anyway, that's kind of heavy-handed all of a sudden. But well, anyway, those were my thoughts after hearing these Jehovah Witnesses. I need to take a short break. Can I play a jingle or anything? Let's just play a little bit of music. A little bit of music, because the next topic that I want to talk about is music, and not just random music, but Star Wars music. So this was a little miracle that happened this week. This is Wednesday. Wednesday was my day off. It was Tuesday, and I'd worked all day long Tuesday. We're currently doing a lot of TV production, so a busy day, and I was looking forward to having the Wednesday off. And to just go for a long walk, do some gaming, read a book, just fun stuff. And then on Tuesday evening, I get a call or a message from one of my parishioners here, who is a math teacher. He's Sebastian. He's the one who introduced me to the wonderful world of board games. And he says, "Would you like to go to a concert with live John Williams Star Wars music?" I was like, what? Turns out he knew people that had bought tickets for a concert called Star Wars A New Hope in Concert in the most famous concert hall of the world, the Dutch Concertgebouw, the Dutch Concert Hall, which has fabulous acoustics. It's probably the best acoustics in the world. So it's a beautiful ancient concert hall in the middle of Amsterdam, and I think 3 or 4 days in a row, an orchestra would play the full score of A New Hope while the movie was being projected on a big screen in that concert hall. So you would have you would actually be able to watch the entire movie, but all the music was going to be performed live. And these people were unable to go to the concert. It was too late to return the tickets. And so they offered it to this math teacher who happened to be in a very busy week, the final week of the school season. And so he's like, "But I know someone who may enjoy this, Father Roderick." And so I ended up going to this concert on Wednesday evening with Martin, my producer here. And I had a blast. It was amazing. I've been streaming the entire thing from not the entire concert, of course, but before the concert and during the intermission and after the concert. Even streamed a bit of the encore because I figured, well, that's the encore. And it was amazing. It made me again realize how incredibly well written this whole soundtrack is. And not just the soundtrack itself, the score by John Williams. This is perhaps the most classical score that John Williams has written before. And I think I've explained this before. John Williams takes a lot of cues from other composers, mostly from Holst. If you listen to The Planet by the classical composer Holst, you will hear Star Wars, A New Hope. So, but it was also amazing to hear it live. And sometimes I had to just pinch myself. Is this really being played live? They did such a terrific job. But also, the music is so much more vibrant in those acoustics. There's no speaker system in any movie theater that can get even close to the quality of the audio of a real performing concert. So it was wonderful. And at the end, you know, the final piece that is played underneath the credits, the final, like the entire hall was standing and applauding and cheering, and I was almost un-Dutch. We usually are not this enthusiastic, but it was so deserved. And so for 4 days, lots of people have been able to enjoy this, and it was amazing. So if that ever happens near where you live, I was like, I didn't even know that there was this concert, but it was fantastic. And made me fall in love again with A New Hope, the movie that I've seen hundreds of times. And this is not exaggeration. I've literally actually watched this movie hundreds of times. There were moments when I got the VHS, the tape, I would actually watch A New Hope almost on a daily basis for weeks, months. Okay, I probably won't say anything else because it's kind of crazy. Speaking of Star Wars, last thing I'm going to say, then I'm going to end the show. Did you read that update about Ahmed Best, who played Jar Jar in The Phantom Menace? I met Ahmed Best at the first Star Wars convention in Denver, but that was before the movie premiered. And he was such a funny, such a nice guy, a relatively young comedian who had scored this major role, first full-fledged CGI character that was also a comedic role. And when I heard him talk on stage, I was like, this is going to be awesome. Well, little did we know that Jar Jar turned out to be a little less awesome than we all hoped. But then Ahmed Best kind of disappeared from the public stage. And now, just recently, he confessed on Facebook. He posted a picture of himself standing on a bridge or something like that with his son. And his comments were heartbreaking. He said, this is where, actually, so many years ago, after the premiere of The Phantom Menace, after all the backlash, I contemplated ending it all. So basically to commit suicide. And then he said, is this little boy that brought me back, or that, you know, is now the treasure of my life. And so, again, turns out that Ahmed Best has been the victim, another Star Wars victim, of this cruelty of these online bullies that dare to call themselves Star Wars fans. We are Banta Poodoo. It's the people that destroy other people online anonymously. They don't deserve to be called Star Wars fans. They're the low lives of the internet. And again, it shows you how much words can hurt. So before you write anything nasty, think about it. Think twice. Count to 100, 100, etc. Always separate the people from the behavior, the things they do. This is also true for politics. Well, if you talk about politicians, etc., always make the distinction between the person who is a child of God, even the worst criminals are, and their behavior that may actually be offensive or bad or wrong, or you may not agree with it. But there's always a distinction. But never destroy the person, the child of God, that does these things. Every person is redeemable in the eyes of God, and so they also should be in your eyes. But never, always, we have a saying, it's always separate the ball from the player. Play the ball, not the player. Not the, it's like in soccer, you know, don't tackle the shins. Don't try to hit the ball, not the legs of this football player that still has a career and a family ahead of him. So anyway, or her. Okay, toxic fan behavior. I'll probably get back to that in the future, but it is time to end this show because, well, I've already hit the 1 hour mark and I'm getting hungry. And I have a cold, by the way. It's stupid. I have a cold in the middle of summertime, and it's a bad cold. My throat is aching. I have the sniffles. Yeah, hopefully that'll be over very soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks to my patrons. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.